I only care about my out-of-pocket. I'm paying $250. The plan, in many of the cases that we work on, I'm not picking on plans, but this is the reality. $100,000 claim comes in. If the spec's $20,000, that plan's saying, well, what do I care about the rest of the bill? Isn't that what I purchased stop-loss for? I purchased stop-loss so that they cover the rest of the bill. What does the member say? Isn't that what I purchased health insurance for?
Right.
That's why I'm paying $20 copay. It's the same exact issue. Now, trick question. What does the stop-loss carrier care about? The entire bill. And here's the rub. If you look at the state and federal regulations, which we're going to talk about next month at our webinar. Okay. By the way, thank you for the hundreds of people that have dialed in today. It's awesome. What do they think? The stop-loss industry, our industry, is doing everything possible to avoid stop-loss carriers being viewed as health insurance companies. Yet in our self-funded health plan space, the only entity that actually cares about the whole health care bill is the stop-loss carrier. So they care about the bill because their money that's being exposed, but yet they have to act like they don't really care because they're not a health insurance plan. They can't really go to a member and say, hey, this is why you should care, because they can't be viewed as being an insurer. Therefore, they'll be subject to state, federal, Obamacare laws, etc. That's the rub. Now, brokers, what do they care about? And folks, I know people love to say their commissions. It's not. What they care about is keeping the plan happy, just like I care about keeping my clients happy, many of you on the call, just like, you know, you care about keeping your clients happy. They want their client happy. And if their client, the plan, is happy by having a stop-loss carrier reimburse a claim above spec, great for them. But at the end of the day, that's what they want. They want their plan to be happy. If I got a dollar for every time I've had a claim, where I know I just need a couple more days or a couple more weeks and I can get a $300,000 bill paid at $100,000 instead of $200,000, saving overall $100,000, and I'm told, no, get it paid. Get it paid. Why? They don't want the noise to continue. So what does this mean? Why do I bring this up? The reason is, at the end of the day, what the providers actually care about is not having to justify their charges. In all these 15,000 cases that we have active and all the other files that we have closed in regards to negotiations, what we know is that I still haven't had a case where a facility who we've told them that, hey, we know that the cost of this implant to your facility was $3,000. You charged $30,000 on your bill for it. I have yet to see a provider come back to me and say, well, here's why I'm charging $30,000. What they say is, well, you're getting a discount, or, well, that's what the contract says, or, you agreed to do this and pay us within 30 days. It's not about justifying what they charge. It's about why they can charge what it is that they charge, not justifying the actual charges themselves or the line items. We don't see that. What happens in most of these cases, and folks, to be honest, it's not about data. It's less about plan design. It's less about the contract. It really comes down to how good of a negotiator are you. It comes down to, can you negotiate? Because in many of these situations, they're like, all right, well, give me 40% off. I'll do 50. All right, give me 45. Okay. It's less about them justifying anything. Now, why do I bring this up? It's because providers will continue to take advantage of the current system as long as all the players that we just talked about don't agree that the overall cost of medical care is the real problem. Until every one of those entities, the patient, the plan, the stop-loss carrier, and the facility, all of us, and the broker, sorry, all of us care about the overall cost as the issue, our entire system won't change. And we bring this up because every issue, every legal issue, every case, every problem that we have really goes back to that same fundamental spot. How do we make this change? Through transparency. And what does transparency mean, folks? Well, let me give you an example of what it doesn't mean. This is what we know. What we know is that right now in the network contract, this is an actual quote that John thankfully pulled out and gave to us, and this is what it says, quote, participating provider agrees to keep and hold its fee schedule confidential. Participating provider shall not disclose such fee schedule except in standard billing to patients or TPAs otherwise. Folks, the key word there is standard billing. What is the standard billing to a member? It is the member seeing IUO amount. It is not $400,000. It says $250, your deductible. That's the standard billing. So a provider in this quote-unquote transparent world isn't allowed to be transparent if they want to be part of the network. That's what it says. So as long as the networks and the contracts are averse to a free market approach, we will never have transparency. What we will continue to have is a situation where members continue to see transparency as being a $10 copay. It will continue to be a plan who has a broker that's not thinking about renewal. The plan has a broker that's thinking about, I need to make that plan happy now, so just get the claim paid. They're only on the hook for the first $50,000 anyways. That broker is not thinking to himself, man, how am I going to renew this plan next year? They're not going to be able to get renewed at a reasonable price because their premium just doubled because they got a lot of exposure to stop loss. This is the current problem. Here's some examples. In a great book that I recently read that I would recommend to all of you, you can Google it. It's Unaccountable by Dr. Marty McCarry. He actually is from Johns Hopkins, one of the best hospitals in the country. This is what he has stated in his book. Salaries of three CEOs of children's hospitals ranging from $5.1 to $6 million. One study estimated that a hospital actually gets paid $10,000 extra for every surgical complication. It's as if Ron and I got paid more money to make mistakes in your plan docs. Maybe that's what we should do.
I was going to say, we don't do that.
No, I guess we got to start doing it. Check this out. 2009, Texas Children's Hospital recorded $275 million profit, and the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, $359 million. I got some information I want to bring up that's not on the slides. Last week in the Boston Globe, the front page of the Globe said, the Department of Insurance in Massachusetts is forced to increase premium for their fully insured plans by 6% in 2016. 6% increase next year for health insurance. The same day, in the same newspaper, in a separate article, it said that Mass General Hospital and Brigham and Women's Hospital have had record profits in 2015. How does that make any sense? The hospitals have record profits, so we have to increase premium so we can pay them more? At the end of the day, that would make sense if it said hospitals losing record amounts of money, therefore we have to increase health insurance costs so we can pay the hospitals more money. The funny thing is, nobody looked at the two articles and said, huh, how does this make any sense? The problem is every entity in our industry is looking at costs from a different perspective. Until we have someone looking at the entire bill, that will not change. We can go to the next slide if you don't mind. This is really important before I turn it over to Ron and we get into the real legal stuff. This is important. This is over the past 10 years. I want to thank Kelly Dempsey, one of our attorneys who got this slide for us. In 2004, you can see what it costs overall for premium for health insurance, $9,950. It's gone up to almost $17,000 in 10 years, 69% total increase. But here's the problem. What the cost shift to the employee has increased by 81%. But at the end of the day, that employee is on the hook for $4,823. That employee is saying, why is my health insurance premiums going up? It's because no one of all those different entities that we've been talking about looks at the bottom line cost as to why in the world XYZ Hospital is charging $30,000 for an implant that cost them $2,000 to get. Until somebody gets involved in that, none of this will change. We know we have the answers on how to make this change, and it's by having skin in the game with each entity. The employers should have skin in the game because obviously their stop loss premiums will go down if they don't have exposure. The employee will have skin in the game if they're getting paid to look for cheaper and same quality or better quality alternatives. And the stop loss carrier has skin in the game because they have the total exposure on the claim as it is. And that broker should have skin in the game because if they do a good job and actually reduce premium or don't cause these increases in costs, premium, they are looked upon like a Superman or a Superwoman, a superhero. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ron to the really exciting stuff, talking about some recent case law, huh?
Thanks, Adam. You know, it's interesting you bring that stuff up, and I got to say, for a while, this has been bothering me.
I remember it was a while ago. I think America Online, the internet provider, they were the
AOL.
CEO. Yeah, AOL.
Right.
The CEO, he was being knocked around in the court of public opinion because he had increased the cost of their self-funded health benefit plan. And when asked publicly why he did it, he indicated that it was because they had had two $1 million premature births on the plan. And everybody freaked out on this guy, probably because he wasn't very well liked. I think at one point he was recorded firing somebody on his staff for eating in one of their meetings, and so people didn't really like him very much. But regardless, everyone went after him for blaming a baby for the cost of the health plan. No one asked why it cost $1 million to have a baby. So, again, I guess if you're the kind of guy who fires people for eating in meetings, people aren't going to take what you say for real, but it, ultimately what he said had some value. So take it into consideration. Why does it cost $1 million to have a baby? I understand we're having lots of those every day. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on, legally speaking, some cases that are very interesting that I think will seriously impact you or impact our industry in general.
At least your plan design.
Hey, speaking of plan design and hot topics, I don't know if anybody was watching the debate last night, but maybe you've heard about this whole same-sex marriage thing. No, it's okay. Go back to Obamacare news. This is what's going on for people who are not living under a rock. We are now seeing a situation where nationally at the Supreme Court level, this is the law of the land. If a state recognizes same-sex marriage, other states have to recognize that license. The constitutionality of same-sex marriage has been upheld. What does this mean for you? Okay, we're not talking about clerks in prison, and we're not talking about whether you agree with it or not. What we're talking about is, as a plan administrator, what does this mean for your plan? Well, people are saying, is this like the contraceptive coverage? Do we have to cover same-sex spouses? You know, if what if we have a religious opposition to it, does that mean the CPA will pay for it the way they pay for the contraceptives?
Slow down. Big difference.
The law says that the employees, the plan participants, must receive contraceptive coverage. How they get it, that's the debate.
The law doesn't say same-sex spouses must receive coverage.
The law says if you provide coverage to a spouse, then you must open it to same-sex. What does that mean? If you have a plan and you don't want to provide coverage to same-sex spouses, just don't provide coverage to spouses at all.
Yeah, that's pretty easy to say.
Yeah. Trust me, I'm married. I wouldn't say that if my wife was listening. But, you know, ultimately, you know, again, people will say, well, you know, we have to cover spouses. Well, if you have to cover spouses, then you're going to have to cover same-sex spouses.
And if you don't, you're going to have some problems.
Absolutely. Not only is there the potential that your plan itself is going to violate law, but in addition to that, you may also be facing allegations of discrimination now that these are protected classes. In addition to that, you know, what does this mean for you? You know, okay, what are we going to do? You got to innovate. I understand. You want to be able to provide robust benefits. Maybe you don't want to cover same-sex spouses. Is there some way to do both? We're going to have to examine the plan document on a case-by-case basis. That is true. One thing that in the immediate sense that you need to do, look at your plan. Make sure that you're not referencing things like DOMA. Make sure that you're not referencing things like specific state law regarding same-sex spouses or the definition of marriage. Don't define marriage in your plan document. If you're defining what a spouse is and you're including, you know, a domestic partner, for instance, and the only reason your plan covers domestic partners is because in the past, same-sex marriage wasn't recognized, and you wanted to extend coverage. Well, you don't have to do that anymore. Hooray, you can get rid of that language. The point is, let's try not to be confusing here. Let's clarify the language. Give us a call. There's only two things I need to know, right? One, what does the language say? Two, what's the plan's intent? You take those two things, adjust the language, bing, bang, boom, we're done.
Now, before John gets into this case, I want to make sure we discuss the fact that this case is actually a pending case. This has not been resolved. It is ongoing, but it's a really important case to discuss. So, John, can you take it from there?
Yeah, you know, this is a case that's going to be much less publicized than the one Ron was just talking about. In this case, Johnson & Towers versus Corporate Synergies Group, this kind of underscores one of the main draws of self-funding. A group had an amendment where it covered widowed spouses of the group's shareholders. like I said, one of the great things about self-funding, you can do things like this. You can cover whomever you want. In a fully insured arrangement, you couldn't even dream of doing something like that.
Right.
So the group had a broker, and the group said to the broker, we want you to get us stop loss. We want you to place it for us. Because, you know, what does the group know about placing stop loss on its own? It doesn't know anything about it. It produces, I have no idea, widgets, let's say. That's probably a good example. So the broker procured stop loss, but the broker failed to get the stop loss carrier to agree to that widowed spouse's amendment.
They actually never gave them a copy of the amendment.
Right. I mean, you know, we can all see where this is going, right? There were claims from one particular widowed spouse to the tune of almost $400,000. And stop loss said, well, you know, guess what? This is not an employee. This is not a spouse of a current employee. So we're not covering it. You know, the underwriting process just didn't entail that widowed spouse amendment.
Now, it's really easy for people to say, oh, why didn't stop loss reimburse? Here's the bottom line. This was a stop loss policy that was well written. The stop loss policy did not have a gap. It basically said, we will reimburse whatever the plan doc says that's a payable claim. That's one very important thing we need to make sure we bring up. The broker never gave a copy of the amendment to the stop loss carrier. So I'm sure, John, that if the stop loss carrier knew, oh, wait a second, so you're telling me there's 100 shareholders and there's a bunch of old widows out there that but I have to cover their potential claims, that premium price might have been a little different than what they actually paid the stop loss carrier for coverage in the first place.
Right.
So what ended up happening here?
Well, what happened, I'll get to that in a second, but just, you know, something to take away from this case is there are a lot of stop loss carriers that will work with you to resolve difficult issues. But when the issue is one that's going to crop up multiple times, when it's that far above spec, you know, we can't really ask stop loss to go that far and above what it has already underwritten. So what do we take from this case? Safeguarding plan assets, not just for plans anymore. TPAs, brokers, consultants, vendors of all kinds, we are all now being held as fiduciaries of the plan. Even the smallest neglected detail can have dire consequences, like forgetting to maybe forward one page of a PDF, for example. I mean, a lot of the times it comes down to things just as simple as that. Everyone can be a fiduciary. The test is generally the same test we ascribe to ducks, right? If it walks like a duck, talks like a duck, and smells like a duck, it's a duck. The same is true with fiduciaries. If it walks, talks, and smells like a fiduciary, it's a fiduciary.
John, what exactly does the duck smell like?
Yeah, it's got that new duck smell to it. You know, don't ask the question.
Just wait for your slide, Chris, huh?
Yeah, just calm it down. And by the way, Chris was eating while Ron was talking about employers firing employees for eating. Yeah, so you might ask, is this counterintuitive, right? Should the broker be responsible for the insurance that covers the plan or the group? And the answer that the court said is, no, it's not counterintuitive. The broker was tasked with protecting the plan. The broker failed to protect the plan. Therefore, the broker is liable as a fiduciary.
And that's why it's very important that you look at, you know, I talk to a lot of brokers across the country, and I ask them, when they're placing stop loss, what is the number one thing that they focus on, and what's the number two thing they focus on when choosing a stop loss carrier? And they always say, the cost.
Right.
They're not looking at the actual policy itself. This case isn't a situation where it's a bad policy. This is a situation where the broker just didn't give the stop loss carrier the correct plan doc with all of its amendments and some fun stuff. And the reality, as we all know, is most plan documents out there are not a clean, restated, beautiful plan. There's typically a lot of amendments, especially what Ron just talked about with same sex. It's probably something you need to amend.
Yeah.
That is why this case is vitally important.
It's a plan document with a lot of amendments duct taped to them, right, Tom?
Nope, that's not right at all. So the question I'm going to ask now, which I think we're going to repeat a few times today, how to be proactive. How do you prevent this from happening to you? You need to be diligent. No matter who you are, a broker, a stop-loss carrier, a vendor, a consultant of any kind, be as diligent as possible because you will become a fiduciary if you are not as diligent as you need to be. So, next case, TrueView versus OneSubC. This is an interesting one because to me, I read this and I just thought this is one of the most ridiculous things I've read in a long time. But
I can't believe that this is an assignment case and Ron didn't want to take these slides.
Howard? I'm sure he'll jump in.
All right, John.
So the plan basically had a very, very broad anti-assignment clause. And what it said is any action by a plan participant to anticipate, alienate, sell, transfer, assign, pledge, blah, blah, blah. It didn't specifically identify the provider as someone who could not receive an assignment. It basically just said you cannot assign to anyone. What the court said was that's not okay. So what happened basically was the participant executed an assignment to the provider, as they do, as they can be expected to do in almost every case. The provider submitted claims, and the plan denied the claims and said, well, you're not entitled to receive the assignment, so we're not paying you. The provider appealed. The plan denied on the same grounds, and the provider sued. That's how it got to court. In Texas, the district court said the SPD needs to be much more specific. You cannot simply say no assignments. Instead, what you have to say is no assignments to medical providers. Why?
Unbelievable.
Why exactly the court felt this way, I don't know. It didn't really elaborate. What it said was that generally, broad anti-assignment clauses don't apply to providers, and they're not intended to. But in this case, clearly, it was intended to.
I mean, we're talking about a health plan stating you can't assign. So how does that not relate to health benefits?
The court went into a discussion about how it normally applies to creditors and things of that nature, but obviously that's not the only thing it's intended for. So what the court said is that in order to prohibit an assignment to a provider, the plan needs to be very specific and say providers cannot have benefits assigned to them.
This is Ron. One of the things that scares me about this, and again, I may be completely off base, but there is, generally speaking, in contract law, there's a concept that if a contract is ambiguous or difficult or you can't understand what it means in and of itself in the four corners of the document, generally what the courts will do is they're going to interpret that language so that it favors against the entity that drafted the agreement. Basically, they're punishing you for writing something that's ambiguous. And so my concern is they didn't say this exactly, but my concern is that this court, their philosophy or their attitude is, well, you know, it's the plan administrator that drafted this document. This provision is so broad and so ambiguous, we're going to interpret it against the drafter, which, like I said, is general contract law. Now, we know that, particularly with a private self-funded ERISA plan, but self-funded benefit plans in general, usually that rule doesn't apply, and the drafter, the plan administrator, gets some discretionary authority and they get some deference from the court. So my concern is this possibly an example of someone going in the other direction? And the other thing I want to point out, we frequently talk about the Oceana case where a plan was able to enforce its anti-assignment clause and was not forced to honor assignment to a provider. So you look at that case compared to this one and you start to understand what you need to do if you plan on prohibiting assignment of benefits.
Right. So now I'm going to turn it over to Chris, and he's going to describe another set of interesting cases we've got.
To continue down this path of figuring out whether you can duck your financial designation as a fiduciary.
Come on. We will never use that word duck again.
We've been talking about this a lot, right? Who is a fiduciary? What makes you a fiduciary? Look, these cases, the next two cases are similar and very different all at the same time. And it's important to understand that the overarching theme here is what, you know, the courts don't truly understand the difference between an ASO and a TPA. And in both of these cases, the sort of the sensationalization of the decision suggests, you know, ERISA doesn't preempt state prop pay laws, which is the first case we're going to talk about. When if you read the decision, it's much narrower than that. So what happened in Aetna? Basically, the administrator, Aetna Life, operating as an ASO, processed claims in accordance with the terms of the plan, but outside of the Texas Prompt Pay Act requirements. And the hospital system tried to hold them responsible for $10 million in fees. So what did Aetna do? So basically Aetna said, look, this is a self-funded plan, therefore we're not bound by the prompt pay laws of Texas. So what did the court say? If you read the case, you start to see how they meld the concepts of an ASO and a TPA. They talk about how Aetna basically is a plan, how basically because they are doing all of the functions that a plan is supposed to take on, that they are tantamount to the plan, and that ultimately they can be held responsible for this. Now,
the key word here being, I think, is that they can be held as a payer. And that, from a TPA standpoint, and again, when I saw this case, Chris, and I saw that an ASO was able to get in trouble for this, then I go, okay, in the TPA world, which many of the people on this call are TPAs, right? You know, they go out of their way to argue that they are not payers. We already saw this case happen in Texas, right? We're not going to repeat the name of the TPA there. But we already saw this case happen in Texas where they were deemed a payer. Because let's be honest, guys, it's a lot easier to go after one payer, quote-unquote TPA administrator, than it would be to go after 500 separate self-funded employee benefit plans and try to recoup the fees from them.
Another interesting thing that came to mind on this case is, doesn't it seem like some of the stuff we've been seeing in the stop-loss realm, right? A backdoor way for the states and the government to try to regulate self-funded plans, right? Well, we can't regulate the self-funded plans themselves, so maybe if we try to attack the parties, the entities that, you know, help govern and help work through these self-funded plans, we'll make it less desirable to be in that space. That's what these cases are starting to look like. It's another way to regulate self-funding without regulating self-funding directly. So what did the court say? TPA can be held liable for breaching the State Prompt Pay Act. And again, here's some of the key points, right? TPA, and they use the term TPA. They call it a third-party administrator over and over and over and over again. The TPA, after all, is responsible for the actual ministerial payment obligations.
Meaning clicking the button.
Exactly. Okay. It doesn't matter who's funding the claims. They're responsible for sending the payment. ERISA doesn't protect them because they are not a traditional ERISA entity. Therefore, we can impose our laws against them. What an incredible jump in logic that's happening in these cases without any real discussion of how is an ASO different than a TPA? Well, one of the reasons, hey, guess who wrote that plan? The ASO did, right? A TPA is helping the plan do different things like cost containment and carve-outs and all this fun stuff. We know how this works. ASO walks in, gold, silver, bronze plan, which one do you guys want? They pick it. The TPA, and I'm using air quotes here, the ASO actually wrote the plan. So is an ASO more like a payer? Yeah, I think they are more like a payer because they're doing what? They're taking on all of the discretion, all of the fiduciary responsibility. The only thing they're not doing is actually providing the money.
And that's why it's important when you look at that fiduciary responsibility, maybe even having the ability to shift that responsibility to another party would make things a lot nicer and sweeter and cleaner. But at the end of the day, you know, all the TPAs that we have on this call who have language saying we are just basically just doing nothing. We're just processing because you tell us how to process. This case goes a long way to link that administrator as part of the reason why those claims are being delayed. It's almost as if they're blaming the TPA for the reason why the payment is late. It's their fault, the claims are being delayed. And that's one of the facts I would like to probably know about this case that maybe we don't know as much about, is why did they pay them late? Was it, like in a TPA world, if this was a TPA rather than Aetna, would it be like, you know, they could have paid it, they just forgot. Are there a bunch of claims they just didn't pay in 30 days, they paid in 40 days, no mistake by the plan, or is it there was no money in the bank account to pay the claim?
Right.
Whose fault was it? I think that probably should have some aspect as to how these cases are decided.
But also, the TPA isn't the one deciding when they can actually pay. The ASO is making that call. The TPA is not ever making that call.
That's true.
There are, you know, we've talked about the stop loss, the network issues, all these issues that come up when you're trying to make these decisions that with the most aggressive plans, they're involved. They're telling you pay, don't pay, brokers, I want the noise. You know, I mean, it's a different world, and that's not being reflected in the rhetoric that's coming out of the courts in these decisions, and that's scary. So on to the next case, the New York Psychiatric Association versus United Health Group. Guys, same situation, right, in ASO. The ASO processed claims, mental health claims, allegedly differently than they would have processed the regular health claims. And they got tagged for it. There's two very important things here. The same distinction I mentioned earlier, ASO versus TPA. What's the difference? An ASO wrote the plan. They're interpreting, if you will, their own plan. They are making their own decisions. They're just paying with someone else's money. And so, again, very interesting that there's no distinction made between the difference between an ASO and a more traditional self-funded plan through a TPA. But the other very big thing that's coming out of this case that's really, really scary is that the providers are being allowed to use ERISA to basically hold the administrator responsible for the for things, violations of mental health parity, which, again, begs the question, okay, with an ASO, they wrote the plan. But if the TPA is doing exactly what the plan says, and it's just administering the plan, it literally cannot make do it any differently, but the courts are saying, and we can hold you, TPA, responsible for making decisions that you didn't make.
I think it's really important, though. We have to make sure we bring up this on the bottom tab here. It says specifically the ASO exercises sole and absolute discretion to deny benefits and makes final and binding decisions.
Yep.
Most people ask all the time, especially nowadays, you know, what's the difference between an ASO and a TPA? Aren't so many TPAs owned by the carriers anyways? And I would tell you the biggest distinction, other than being able to purchase your own stop loss, I guess, is one of the key benefits of a TPA, that you can shop stop loss, is that who is making the decision, how much is being paid, when it's being paid, who it's being paid to, all the decisions are held by the plan, typically in an SPD. So when we read a summary plan description, guys, just the people, that are listening dialed in, if we literally took our plan doc, right, and you go to the search section and look up the word discretion and just hit search, you'll notice that in the plans, they'll say the plan has discretion to interpret the terms of the plan. The plan is the fiduciary. The plan makes the decisions, not the administrator. The plan sponsor does those things. And that ultimately is a big distinction between the ASO world and the TPA world. You can like it or not like it, but that's the big distinction that we got to make sure we bring up in this case. So when you see a case like this, you know how to explain the decision and the differences between the two. But Chris, can you tell us, you know, how does this, you know, what do we do with this case? What do we learn from this case?
Right. I mean, again, we're going down that theory, that whole concept of whether you think you're a fiduciary, whether you want to be a fiduciary is irrelevant. The courts are more and more deciding that what you do is like what a fiduciary does, and therefore you're a fiduciary. You have to protect yourself. You have to make sure you're – I mean, we always say, you know, it's what you do, not what you say. But it probably lends itself that you should say it. Say it loudly. Say it aggressively. Say it over and over again. Make sure your documents reflect the difference between you and the plan.
Okay, a couple of things I want to bring up here. I think this is very important. So for every administrator on this call, this is something I would just jot down. First, obviously you all have ASAs that say that you're not making a decision. I get it. That's the easy part. That's the easy stuff that we see. Here's the stuff that a law firm's not going to tell you, with all due respect to the law firms that might be on this call, okay? Do you have correspondence in your office right now that says we, or just your administrator's name? Does it say XYZ TPA has denied your claim? XYZ TPA needs additional information to make the payment decision. If you don't have reference the plan in every one of your letters and say, blah, 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 employee benefit plan administered by XYZ TPA says, et cetera, and if you don't have the plan's name in every letter, or at least say your employee benefit plan that we administer, if those words aren't in your correspondence, change it today. Going forward, every time you make a denial, a reference, need more information, any correspondence, you need to say that you're all you are is administering claims on behalf of XYZ employee benefit plan. That is where you are not, quote-unquote, walking like a duck. You're stating in the letter that you're just doing this on behalf of the plan, number one. Number two, your people can't act like they're making the decisions. Great example. I had a big case. I mentioned this a couple times this week. We had a big case where I was brought in as an expert witness to tell the mediator that TPAs are not fiduciaries, right? The plans are. So they brought in, let's just call her Julie. And Julie was with this administrator for 30 years. And she was the claims manager. And Julie's been there literally since she was in grade school. So the attorney for the plan who's arguing that the TPA makes all the decisions, the attorney for the plan is telling Julie, you moved up in the company, right?
Yeah.
Julie, you're the best claims manager there is, right?
Yes.
You have all these people in your department that looked up to you, Julie, right?
Yep.
Julie, who makes the claim decisions in your office? And Julie says, I do. Case over. Julie, the claims manager, is telling the attorney for the self-funded plan
in open court
that she makes the claim decisions. You're talking like a duck. You're walking. You're running. You're smelling. You're swimming.
You definitely smell.
You're floating like. I mean, literally, everything the TPA says. Our ASO says we're not a fiduciary. Our letters say we're not a fiduciary. Then comes in Julie, the claims manager. Yep, I make the decisions because I'm the best. Case over. This is the kind of thing that you just got to make sure your people are trained. If you ever receive an email from FIA, many people at FIA, you'll notice on the bottom of their emails, it specifically says, we're giving you advice, we're giving you our opinion, we're trying to help you out, but hey, we're not making any claim decisions here. That's the bottom line. Well, unless you pay us to, then we can't. But the point being, that is an important thing that you got to make sure. You don't just have it in your contract and in your documents, but your people, your behavior, and your people is the same. Ron?
Yeah, I was just going to say, if any of you, and I'm sure everyone on the phone who's with a third-party administrator has probably seen this, have you ever been served or contacted by an attorney where they're referencing you as XYZ TPA Insurance Company, InkLLC.com, right? If an attorney and your own plan participant think you are an insurance carrier like Geico or Progressive
or Aetna,
right? Obviously, there's some miscommunication there. And if an attorney or a plan participant can mistake you as an insurance carrier, there's no reason a court can't make the same mistake.
So we've got, I think, is this the last case?
This is the last case, yeah. And then we have some internal cases that we know about.
Yes. All right, this is a really interesting one. And this comes down to the area of subrogation, which we have not really talked about much today, and I know Chris is going to want to jump in on this because he just can't get enough to subro. So in Illinois, a court has recently said that the applicability of Illinois' state law common fund doctrine depends on who brings the claim, the member or the attorney. If the member brings the claim, then a case that a lot of you may remember, McCutcheon, will govern. If the attorney brings the claim, it's an entirely different story. What happens when the attorney brings the claim, it gets a little different. This case comes down to, essentially, when federal courts and state courts look at ERISA issues and SPD issues, one of the first things that happens is that the case gets removed to federal court, because federal court is the court that's supposed to be interpreting ERISA, and SPDs governed by ERISA. In this case, though, Illinois took a very interesting approach. What Illinois did is it said it wasn't interpreting an SPD. It wasn't interpreting ERISA. It was interpreting state law. And when everybody kind of said, wait, what? It stuck to its guns. And it said, well, the attorney is bringing the common fund case separately from the plan's recovery, meaning the plan recovered its full lien. And the attorney said, well, you know, common fund means that you need to reduce the plan's recovery proportions to the attorney's fees. And the attorney said, absolutely not. State law says we don't have to recover. And the plan, as can be expected, said, well, the plan's not governed by state law. The plan's governed by federal law. The Illinois court said the plan is governed by federal law, but the attorney is governed by state law.
The attorney representing the patient.
Right.
Listen, I'll be honest. This is pretty creative.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, what they're saying is, okay, plan, you're right. You have the right to get all your money. But I, the attorney for the patient, who brought this case to court in the first place, I feel that you owe me something now. You got paid in full, but you wouldn't have got that money without my quote-unquote work. So you're unjust enrichment.
Unjust enrichment.
You're getting this money that you're allowed to get, but it doesn't say that I can't get paid. So basically, think of it like, close your eyes and think of it like the attorney creates a separate invoice on his own and says, hey, by the way, I did the work. You were okay with me doing the work. You got your money. Here's my bill. A great example that we all learned in law school that this case ties into is, you remember from law school where they said, you know, if every day you go home and there's a guy painting your house.
Yes, I love this.
and they don't stop, and you don't stop the guy from painting the house.
Right.
And eventually, he finishes painting after like a month. And he walks up to you and says, hey, here's my bill, $5,000. You go, I never approved for you to paint the house. I never made a deal with you. You let the guy openly and notoriously,
I love, I can't remember those words,
15 years, paint the house.
Right.
You didn't stop him. Unjust enrichment. It's very similar to, in my mind, I can see this argument.
Yeah.
It's a scary argument for our industry, but it's a pretty clever argument being brought up by the plaintiff attorney.
If you haven't dickered the terms, you haven't agreed on the fee ahead of time, there is a possibility you don't have to pay what they're asking for. But if they can establish what the fair market value for their services based on what it costs them, what it would have cost you to go elsewhere, the actual resources, they could establish at a minimum what the equitable value of their services, and you're going to have to pay.
Right. There's a really great quote from this case that's below here on the slide. What this quote basically says is, we recognize that the United States Supreme Court said one thing. We're going to go a different route.
And, guys, it's important to note that this is actually...
It's like that woman in Kentucky.
Yeah, right.
So this was the Bishop line of cases in Illinois before. In the Seventh Circuit, really good circuit typically for benefit plans in subro, but Illinois said before McCutcheon, listen, we don't really care. Under the Bishop doctrine, you're going to have to pay the fee. So McCutcheon comes out, finally clears up this whole issue. There is, you cannot apply equitable limitations if the plan says so, and Illinois is just saying, hey, we still don't care. Bishop still applies. We're just going to put it under this different case now. It's just the state saying we're just not going to do what you tell us to do. But it's going to hold until a different court does something about it.
So what's going to happen here, John? What do we think is going to happen here?
It's going to be interesting, right? I mean, this is going to be – it's going to drag on. There's no question about that. I assume that there will be some federal law involvement at some point. I don't see how there couldn't be. And whether or not Illinois decides to go with it or not, I can't say.
So basically, if someone out there isn't working with us in regards to subrogation and you have a case in Illinois, these might be situations where you might want to have those cases looked over by us, particularly since now it's a new wrinkle that's being brought forward that wasn't there before. So just important to just let you guys know.
And there are definitely some fun arguments you can use for some of these attorneys. And guys, let's be real. Most plaintiff's attorneys, they either don't know this or aren't very good at it. So you can bend this to get more than a one. But less than a one-third reduction on these.
Got it. So it's like the Patriots defense. Bend but don't break.
Yeah.
All right. That works for me too. Okay, so let's bring this home. Huh? We started by talking about the relationships between the parties. Let's finish this by talking about the relationships between the parties. And I love talking about relationships. I care about every type of client we have, brokers, stop loss, MGU, TPA, ASO, you name it. If I forgot you, I apologize. It's important, like Adam said, that we get on the same page. And I don't think anything really reflects the lack of cooperation or communication that there is currently amongst our industry members, as well as some of the conflicts we see between the plan, the TPA, and the stop loss. And unfortunately, right now, stop loss is square in the crosshairs of the regulators that are looking to limit not just stop loss, but self-funding in general, and there's a number of reasons why self-funding is under attack. We're not going to waste a lot of time going through things like adverse selection and the negative impact on Obamacare and the exchanges that self-funding has, the fact that you're hoarding the healthy lives and sending the sick lives off to the carriers, and all this stuff that makes self-funding enemy number one, and the fact that self-funding, like the back of a duck, all of their attempts roll right off. You're the Teflon kid. They can't get you because of ERISA preemption. But ha-ha, backdoor regulation of self-funded plans by making stop-loss hard, if not impossible, to obtain, particularly for the small employers that need stop-loss the most. They are looking to regulate stop-loss and thereby limit the impact of self-funding in the state and nationally. And we are helping that effort every time there is miscommunication or conflict between the parties. Example. One that I've been dealing with again and again. And this type of thing should have happened once, and we should have all learned from it, and it should never happen again. And yet, it keeps happening. When is a claim paid? If you want to get stop-loss reimbursement, and you need to pay the claim first, please look at what the definition of paid is. In most policies, it has something to do with when the check
hits the mail. It's pretty old school.
The mailbox rule.
This is old school law school stuff, guys.
But we're back in the first year.
Tell me about it. This is 1L stuff. The mailbox rule. The problem is, if you issue instructions to a third party and tell that third party, hey, withdraw funds from this account and issue the check, and time passes between the point you issue that instruction and the check hits the mail, just because you issue the instruction in a timely fashion, if the check doesn't hit the mailbox in time, that carrier, if they can prove it, could potentially say you didn't pay timely, you missed the deadline, that big end of December rush to get the checks out, you may fall short. Now the employer is mad, the broker is mad, the TPA is mad, the carrier is mad. We're all at each other's throats at the worst possible time, right before renewal. So that's issue number one. We need to get that straightened out. Please confirm what the definition of paid is. Make sure you're getting it paid on time. Make sure you have evidence that it was paid on time. And if you don't think something is going to be paid on time, let the carrier know ahead of time. I understand a lot of people have the attitude that it's better to beg forgiveness than ask permission, but I'm discovering again and again when it comes to these relationships, that is not the case. Issue number one. Issue number two, the reliance on things like advanced funding. Most policies that I've seen, there are additional rules when it comes to advanced funding. Standard stop loss, you pay the claim, you exceed the spec deductible, you issue a request for reimbursement, hopefully you get the reimbursement, otherwise you appeal. Got it, easy. Advanced funding, it may be that you need to submit a request for advanced funding within a certain period of time before the policy terms. Often it's 30 days, give or take. I have seen situations where the information that's being provided to the carrier, it's either not enough for them to make a determination, or maybe it is and they're just dragging their feet. But either way, if you hit that 30 days and you haven't received advanced funding, yeah, okay, maybe you have a claim against the carrier. Maybe you want to say that they wrongfully withheld advanced funding. But ultimately, the responsibility to pay the provider is still there. And who's responsible to pay the provider? The plan. And if the plan doesn't pay, provider's going to do one of two things. Either A, they're going to file a claim against the plan, or B, they're going to balance bill the patient, or C, they're going to do both. But the one thing the provider is not going to do is say, hey, I got your back. Let's go after that stop-loss carrier. Not going to happen. So, again, keeping an eye on the deadline, understanding what your obligations are, making sure that you understand what stop-loss is and what it isn't.
We just see way too many advanced funding issues. And the fact is, most of these issues don't need to be issues at all.
Absolutely not.
Especially in
some instances, I'm talking to the people in play, and they're like, oh, no, we have money in the plan, but we wanted to go through advanced funding. I'm like, you're going to lose a discount, or I can't negotiate a good enough rate because we're getting holed up over this advanced funding issue, and you could save yourself $100,000 if you just funded it out of the money you just told me you have.
And Chris's reference to the discount, you know, that's another end, and we could have a whole other webinar about this. We're not going to do it, but, you know, when we talk about discounts and network contracts, the contract is between the plan or the TPA and the network and the provider. Stop loss is not a party to that network. So, one, they're not required to honor the timeline or the deadlines that you're required to honor, number one. And number two, you know, if they are relying on a discount and because of a dispute between the plan, the TPA, and the stop loss, the discount is lost, who's ultimately responsible for that lost discount? Time causes loss. And anything you can do now to avoid these conflicts and questions and ambiguities later that will create time sucks and money lost, you need to address it now. And if you can't, based on your experience, guess at what these conflicts are going to be unless they come up, give us a call. We've seen it all. We'll look at the policy. We'll look at the plan document. We'll look at it from a third-party perspective and say, hey, I can see a potential conflict here. We should get this resolved before it ever comes up. Guess what? If that issue never happens, great. But it doesn't hurt to have the resolution, the solution before it happens. The reason this is so important is because we're seeing really weird stuff. In Connecticut, and a lot of people are talking about this now, they issued this bulletin regarding new regulation that's going to impact stop loss, and it basically requires stop loss carriers to cover plans section for section, line for line. It eradicates lasers. You can't have lasers anymore, so you're going to have to quote the rate based on the entire population. You have to mirror the plan. Now, a lot of carriers are going to say, well, that's not a problem. We always mirror the plan. Yeah, okay. You mirror the plan textually, but not in intent. And that's the difference between a soft gap and a hard gap. A hard gap is when the language differs. Policy says all illegal acts, plan document says felonies only. That's an obvious difference. But what happens when there's language in the plan that's ambiguous? Now, a lot of people have brought up to me the fact that in this bulletin it says that if a plan is not legally required to pay a claim, then stop loss is not required to reimburse it. Meaning that if a plan on its own voluntarily pays a claim that's not required to be paid by the plan per the terms of the plan, stop loss is not locked in by that plan's decision. However, I'm still worried when there's language in the plan documents that is ambiguous, whether we're talking about usual and customary, medically necessary, experimental, investigational, stuff like that. If the plan decides something is reasonable, usual, customary, payable, and the stop loss, reading the same exact language, feels otherwise, is stop loss required to do what the plan said? Was the plan legally required to pay that claim, or did they choose to pay that claim? That ambiguity is going to burn you. So, you know, I guess right now I'm hearing across the board different responses from the stop loss industry. Some carriers are saying that if they see ambiguous language in a plan document, they're not going to issue coverage unless that plan revises the language to be more explicit, clear, and agreed upon. Others are saying that if there is ambiguous language, they need to have an agreement ahead of time what the ambiguous language means. Others are saying if they see ambiguous language, they're just going to increase their rates. And then last but not least, some are saying, I'm just not cutting coverage in Connecticut anymore. So we'll keep an eye on this and let you know as it develops.
We're actually going to be talking about this at next month's webinar as well, so make sure you tune in for that. So really quickly, a couple of things we want to bring up before we let you go. Ron and I finally have some help here at FIA. We brought in Joe Montalto as our new chief operating officer. You might have seen that in this past week's Ernie Clevenger's newsletter. We're really excited about it. We have two other big announcements that we're going to be making over the next month between now and the next webinar. So we're really pumped about it. One is a new service. Another is another person that's going to be coming aboard. I also want to say it's been a long time since the four of us have all been in the office together, so it's pretty cool that the fall is here and we're going to be doing this. So I want to make sure I say thank you to all you folks. Feel free, as always, to email any one of us. We are doing a webinar next month on Wednesday, the 14th of October, right before the SIA conference. What we will be talking about goes right to what Ron talked about in Connecticut. It's going to be called a call to action, proposed state and federal regulations, bulletins, litigation, industry developments, and troubling trends. At the end of the day, we're going to talk about these are the states where we need your help. Ron has talked to all the big players all the industry associations. What states do they need help writing letters to politicians? Where do we see the most legislative action? Where do we see threats to self-funding? And we're going to talk about them both from an external state and federal side, but also just internally in our industry. What type of trends are we seeing that are hurtful to our industry as a whole? So with that, I just want to say thank you to Chris, to John, to Ron, to the duck that's been here the entire time.
Perfect.
And thank you to all of the hundreds of you that have listened in. We appreciate your business. We appreciate your loyalty and your passion for this industry. And we'll talk to all of you again next month. Thank you.